From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, bringing death out of the closet, we talk with medical ethicist Daniel Callahan about what we make of dying, how our fears and misunderstandings about it shape social and medical policy and the way we live. Callahan's new book is The Troubled Dream of Life. Also, you could call actor Jerry Adler a late bloomer, at least when it comes to acting. He got his start at the age of 62 after a behind-the-scenes career as a stage manager and director on Broadway. Now he's starring in Woody Allen's Manhattan Murder Mystery. And commentator Annie Lamott tells us about her latest addiction. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Two U.S. C-130 transport planes today dropped about 13,000 packages of food over the embattled Muslim enclave of Mostar in Bosnia. The food was in the form of prepackaged rations. Earlier today, the United Nations Refugee Relief Agency asked Western allies to organize rapid airdrops of food to the 55,000 Muslims trapped by Bosnian Croats in Mostar, saying they had only a few days' supplies left. The Bosnian foreign minister said he does not support the new borders proposed for his country when he says Bosnia is forced to accept being reorganized into three parts. NPR's Scott Simon reports from Sarajevo.
Foreign Minister Haris Selajic said the new borders proposed for Bosnia would increase the number of refugees in the region, fail to resolve national rivalries, create economically weak nations, and violate the UN Declaration of Human Rights. But the foreign minister said Bosnia is willing to make a revised form of that map work just to stop Bosnia's suffering.
I'm afraid that the disintegrative factors will continue even after the agreement. But I agree that peace and human lives are above everything.
Mr. Selajic said the map that left Geneva would deprive Bosnia of international trade routes, particularly important to rebuilding the country, and reward Serbian and Croat forces who committed massacres in the name of ethnic cleansing, with the land they sought. This is Scott Simon in Sarajevo.
Still no word from the Mars Observer space probe, raising doubts about the success of the billion-dollar mission. The craft has not responded to controllers since Saturday. It was expected to put itself into orbit around Mars today, then reestablish contact with Earth. Scientists can't be sure if the craft actually did move into orbit. Even so, if communications are not restored, the mission will be a serious loss. Amtrak train service should not be disrupted tomorrow. The federal judge has issued a temporary restraining order barring union workers from going on strike. NPR's Tui Vu reports.
U.S. District Judge Stanley Harris signed the order this afternoon, although its exact details remain unknown. The order prohibits the United Transportation Union from going ahead with a strike planned for tomorrow. The union represents more than 2,300 Amtrak workers. At issue is a dispute over a work rule that allows maintenance crews to operate trains undergoing service at Amtrak facilities. The UTU wants Amtrak to put union conductors on those trains. Amtrak, however, defends its current policy as cost-effective. The passenger railroad carries 22 million people a year. About half of them commute along the busy rail corridor linking Boston and Washington. The government had been monitoring talks between Amtrak and the union, but there were no efforts to mediate. I'm Tui Vu in Washington.
Stock prices were generally higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 33 points. This is NPR News. Talks may get underway soon between UN officials and the political faction controlled by Somali warlord Mohamed Aidid. But Aidid and other top factional leaders will not be present at the talks, and little is expected to come from the dialogue. Aidid is wanted by the United Nations in a series of ambushes in June that left 24 Pakistani peacekeepers dead. A test doctors commonly perform to check for the spread of colon cancer is of questionable value, according to a report in the latest Journal of the American Medical Association. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
The test, called a CEA test, looks for a protein produced by colon cancer cells. The test isn't accurate enough to screen for cancer in the general population, but many doctors rely on the CEA test in people with colon cancer to tell them whether the cancer has returned following surgery and whether further treatment is needed. In the new study, researchers from the Mayo Clinic and other institutions monitored 1,017 patients who had colon cancer. They found that the CEA test missed a lot of cancer recurrences, about 4 in 10, and the test falsely showed the spread of cancer in 1 out of 6 cancer-free patients. The researchers concluded that the $55 test saves the lives of fewer than 1 in 100 colon cancer patients and puts many more through needless testing and worry. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
A federal judge today opened cable television markets to more competition by allowing telephone companies to provide video programming in many areas served now only by one cable company. Judge T.S. Ellis in Alexandria, Virginia, overturned a 1984 rule that barred regional telephone companies from offering cable service in the same areas that provide phone service. Ford Motor Company said today it will present the United Auto Workers Union an economic package tomorrow for a new national contract. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Death is one of the few remaining taboos in this country. Many people die without wills. Few have written advance directives detailing the heroic measures they do or do not want use when they are near death. And we have a medical system that has invested heavily in technology to prolong life at great cost. Daniel Callahan is director of the Hastings Center and a leading medical ethicist. He says we have made death the enemy, and that makes us different from most other countries. It also makes our healthcare system the most expensive in the world. In his new book, The Troubled Dream of Life, Callahan argues that it's time to talk frankly about dying. A public debate about the quality of death, Callahan says, will have great cultural and psychological payoffs. In our discussion today about death, I began with the story of Amy and Angela Lakeberg, the conjoined twins who were just surgically separated. Amy died during the operation, and Angela is given only a slim chance of surviving. As a policy, Callahan has advocated the rationing of health care. I wanted to know what he thought of this case.
I have indeed argued for rationing, but really rationing is part of a national health care scheme and plan, not a kind of ad hoc rationing at the bedside. This was surely a very expensive experimental operation. The bill will go not only as high now, but it's going to go on for months and months. I think we ought to do this kind of thing, even if one can think of better ways to spend the money, perhaps better ways of saving other lives, if only because we don't have a rational healthcare system. We should not put doctors in the position of making sort of ad hoc decisions case by case as to whether the country can afford to pay for this. So in general, I suppose one's attitude, I think at this point, has to be, is this an operation likely to benefit the person who is going to be the beneficiary if things work out well?
What does the price tag for this operation, what issues does that raise for you?
Well, to me, the fundamental issue is how do we set priorities in this country? We know that there are a large number of children who don't get immunization, a common example. We've just passed a bill. We've seen a bill passed to take care of that. We know there are plenty of children that don't get primary care. We know that there are even children who are malnourished in this country. I suppose the fundamental question is how in the world do you justify spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to save the life in a rather extraordinary, rare kind of medical event versus taking the same amount of money and spending it in ways that might help hundreds or even thousands of other children. I think part of our problem in this country is we're addicted to technology. We're addicted to a kind of gambling to save life. And this is wonderful. There's a kind of romance about that, and indeed lives are saved. The price, however, is that we often neglect, overlook those very simple things that could probably save a lot more lives in the long run than these high-technology ventures.
My guest is Daniel Callahan. He's the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center and a widely quoted expert on the issue of ethics and medicine and the author of a new book called The Troubled Dream of Life. Let's talk, if we can, about some of the ideas in your new book. And one of the things you argue for is a new or a common meaning of death. And I'm curious, as a man who I assume is in his middle age, how much do you think about your own death?
Well, I don't think about it on a daily basis. I suppose I think about it, first of all, when I read the obituary page and I see people I know or people I've perhaps simply people at a distance that I admire that have died. And then I said, my gosh, one of these days I'm going to be on that page. And, of course, the older one gets, the more one sees people dying around one's own age, and that makes it much more real. I think about it also partly because I believe as one gets older, one has to really say, what kind of a life do I want to live? How do I want to wrap my life up? When I look back on my life, what has that life been like? So it really, death is obviously a very final and fundamental measure of our life. And the question is, how do we approach that death? How do we think about it? And I suppose, in retrospect, what will we make of our life once that moment comes?
What steps have you taken to put some controls, I guess, on the type of death that you want?
Well, like many others, I've signed an advance directive. I've specified what kind of treatment I do and do not want. But I've added one thing that most people don't add, and that is to say, if there is any uncertainty about the decision, then don't treat me. Frequently, people forget that most of medicine is uncertain, particularly in critical situations of life and death. And I think there's a kind of illusion, really, that when the final moment comes, a doctor will have a very clean, tidy decision to make, or a family will have such a decision. Unhappily, things are often gray and murky. And to me, the critical question is, what do you do when you are uncertain or your family's uncertain? And I think at that point, you have to decide in advance what you want done. My choice is, look, if there's doubt, let me go.
As a society, how would you say this country thinks about death, thinks about dying?
We are, I've decided, really an anomalous, strange, even odd country. Many European physicians and others who come here think that we believe death can be overcome if you simply throw enough money and science at it. We are much more likely than other countries to hide death, either through funeral services and funeral rites or memorial services, than is the case elsewhere. And I think in particular, we've invested a great deal of hope in medicine, that somehow medicine in the end is going to beat death and beat illness. And when this doesn't happen, we simply say, well, that's because we haven't really developed the good enough science to do it yet. And you just don't find this in other countries. Other countries, for whatever reason, they seem to be much more willing to face the reality and, in fact, to build the kind of rituals and culture to make death never totally acceptable, but at least tolerable and a part of life. We're a bizarre nation in that respect.
Would you say it's a kind of a frontier spirit gone awry, this sort of antagonistic view of anything that stands away in our future, this idea of manifest destiny, which is so much a part of the American culture?
That's certainly part of it. We're enormously optimistic as a country. I think the thing that strikes me when I often talk with Europeans about medicine, life or death, is Europeans, perhaps because of their war and their culture, perhaps because they don't have any further frontiers, they tend to be more pessimistic, a little more cynical about life in general. They don't entertain great vaulting hopes the way we do in this country. And that certainly expresses itself in our medicine, where we've been a leader in research throughout the world, and that's one sense, that's wonderful and it's good. Another sense, it bespeaks our kind of sense that my gosh, there's nothing that we cannot overcome if we would just work hard enough, including death, illness, aging, and disease.
Would you say that as a society that we have lost our ability to know how to behave around death? I'm thinking of a pretty common question people say when they hear about someone who's died. They say, "What do I say? What do I do? Do I call them? Do I come and visit?" The rituals don't seem to quite fit what has happened when someone dies.
I think that's exactly the case. I've noted in my own situation, family members or even a child, how awkward people felt and how important it was to find ways of putting, they came to help me, to put me at ease. I found that very often I had to help them. And even though I was in a situation of grief, it was, one couldn't help observing that people are simply awkward. We don't have a common language. We simply, somehow, by virtue of death being seen as such a tragedy, such an insult, we feel that somehow there are no words that can adequately express what we feel or ought to feel, and sometimes people just don't have those words. Whereas, in fact, language is meant to sort of fill in the gaps, and Even though it sounds trite to say it, I think there's a lot to be said for almost ritual, formalistic ways of responding in situations like that. It's nice to know that what you usually say is, and then you can say, well, we loved her, we're really sorry to see her go, or we know how badly you feel. Trite, cliched statements, but it's precisely those kind of things that are sufficient and adequate for most purposes. We're not expected to be original in times of grief or mourning. We're not expected to say anything unusual, but we are expected to say something. And I think what is perfectly serviceable are very ordinary, standard kinds of things. But somehow we don't do that easily.
One of the things that you argue for in your book is to persuade Americans to start to create a common view of death. What is gained if we do that?
Well, first of all, it's going to be very difficult to gain a common view of death. Okay. But one thing we would gain would simply be that we find a way to talk with each other about death, and particularly talk with each other as strangers. I would hope that we would find ways to help each other go through the grieving process. We would find ways to sort of show people our affection for them, our understanding of the suffering they're going through, the sense of their loss, that we remove the kind of awkwardness from the subject, that we turn it much more into an event which is understood to be a part of life. And in that sense, we don't distance ourselves so much from death. I think everything begins in a funny way with talk. We have to learn to talk with each other. And then if we could create some additional symbols and rituals, that would help as well.
Is it possible to talk with the machines going in the background, if you know what I mean?
It's impossible to talk with machines going in the background. And indeed, when I think back, the early 70s, late 60s, when we first really began talking about these issues, the whole death with dignity movement came out of a feeling that life and death in the modern hospital were simply intolerable and inhumane and did indeed cut us off from people we loved at the time of death. Now, of course, we see a strong hospice movement in getting people out of hospitals to die, and most strikingly of late, a very strong efforts on the part of many to die at home to create a very different kind of atmosphere.
You would then support this idea of allowing or encouraging people to die at home?
I encourage
to facilitate the kind of conversations you're talking about?
I think so. First of all, you do set up the possibility of a much better interaction relationship between a person who is dying and family members, and that of course is crucial and fundamental. You also make it much more easier for neighbors and others to drop in and be a presence as well. Whether I would want to encourage it, in general, I would want to encourage it as a movement, but when you get down to individual cases, I think a great deal of delicacy is required. It's not easy sometimes for people to die at home. Families can't, they think that the idea is lovely, but the stress can be enormous, and while the technical problems might be managed, if this goes on for a long period of time, it can be very difficult. So people have to really ask themselves whether they're going to be up to this, whether the family members are going to have the kind of support they need to do this, and indeed to talk very carefully with the physicians about what the actual death is likely to be like.
My guest is Daniel Callahan, and he's an authority on ethics and medicine. He's written a number of books. The latest one is called The Troubled Dream of Life. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Daniel Callahan. His latest book is called The Troubled Dream of Life. Daniel Callahan is also the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center. Part of the problem with death, you say, is that with a lot of high technology treatments, we've created an existence that's something between life and death. Could you describe what that existence is?
Well, first of all, we are able to sustain life for a very long time these days. The process of dying can be strung out almost indefinitely by technology. And at the same time, of course, the quality of life of people living in that state can be very poor. So they're suspended somewhere between life and death. Moreover, there are some conditions, one of which persistent vegetative state, some used to be called irreversible coma, really sees people whose bodies are going, but their brains are long dead. And in that sense, they're in a kind of zombie-like state. There are thousands of people like that around as well. We've made, I believe, the whole process of dying a kind of fuzzy, gray technological event where we're not sure where life begins or death comes in. We don't know where the borderline is anymore. And, of course, for many doctors, it's harder and harder to really tell a family or tell a patient you're dying or not. There's always the hope we can try this, we can try that. Who knows? And what strikes me looking historically at dying in the past is how quickly people died. Basically, you would get an infectious disease, typhoid, smallpox. If it was a plague, you would be sick for a few days. You would either die or you would get well. And if you got well, you were likely to be in perfectly fine health thereafter. Now people die much more slowly of chronic and degenerative disease, cancer, heart disease, stroke. Now, of course, we add AIDS to that. The whole process of dying is strung out, made much more difficult, and you can no longer really even say with any clarity that somebody is dying or not dying. You know in general they are, but if you're trying to make a prediction or even if you're the individual trying to figure out how much longer you have, it's very hard.
I'm wondering how for doctors and treating someone in this vegetative state, for them, what is the difference then between letting a patient die and hastening their death, whether it's withholding food or water, taking them off a respirator? How do they and how do you grapple with this middle area and the choices before physicians?
Well, let me say on the one hand, I am an opponent of euthanasia and an opponent of doctor-assisted suicide. On the other hand, I think doctors need to find it much easier to allow patients to die than is now the case. Doctors are trained to save life. Doctors are trained to use all the technology at their disposal. And doctors are also trained that when in doubt, treat. I believe we're going to have to change many of those attitudes. Doctors are really now tend to believe that if they stop treatment and a patient dies, that somehow they kill the patient. And often families, when asked, should we let the patient go, the families will say, I don't want to kill the patient by doing that. I don't want that machine turned off. I will feel like a murderer. I think that's a mistaken way of thinking. It's a bad psychology. The reality, ultimately, if people have a deadly disease, is that the disease will kill them, not the turning off of a machine. But by virtue, I believe, of their training and the kind of technological cocoon in which modern medicine is practiced, there's a sense that, by God, if you're controlling this technology, if you stop it, you have been the executioner. That is a very heavy burden for doctors to bear.
Dr. Jack Kevorkian has helped a number of people die. People have sought his expertise. Mm-hmm. What issues does his work raise for you as a medical ethicist?
Well, of course, very fundamentally, it raises the questions of whether we want doctors in the business of helping people to take their own lives in the first place. Beyond that, it really raises to me the question, even if we should legitimate or legalize doctors assisting patients, could we in fact regulate it? My own guess is no matter what law we passed on, say, a physician's helping a patient to commit suicide, there would still be the Jack Kevorkians, because there will always be some people who will want what the law will not allow. I'm struck by the fact that many of the people that he's treated are people who are suffering some now, but they are not in extreme suffering. They really have turned to him to avoid future suffering rather than to be relieved of present suffering. And that's one of the worrisome features about what he does.
Is this, though, just the next step in people trying to control the end of their life, trying to control the suffering that they anticipate, being afraid that they're going to be kept alive against their own will?
It certainly, in one respect, looks like that. People are fearful of how they're going to die, and they're particularly fearful of what modern medicine might do to them. Of course, to me, I sort of turn that upside down and think it's sort of one of our perhaps great mistakes is that we have looked to medicine and medical technology to give us somehow a kind of ultimate control over life and death more generally. It's failed to do so. It can't help but fail to do so. and now we take now we want to take the final step. Well, I guess to me the great mistake in the first place was expecting medicine to give us this kind of control, and the turn to euthanasia is simply going to kind of confirm what seemed to me a bad move in the first place.
But if part of what you're arguing for is a more public acceptance of death, a more common understanding of it, putting death rightfully in life and the discussions about life, what's wrong with a doctor, a good doctor, helping people die?
To me, I suppose there are a number of things wrong. First of all, I think it would make for a very fundamental change in the medical professions. Doctors would for the first time historically really take on the role of killing people or helping them kill themselves, which has been long forbidden, and I think forbidden in great part because of the very power of doctors. Doctors, by virtue of their technical skills, know how to kill very effectively. I think, to me, it would be a great social mistake to give doctors this extra power. I'm also, concerned with the fact that we live in a society which has never done a very good job with legalized killing. We allow killing now in the name of capital punishment, in the name of self-defense, and just warfare. We have made a terrible mess, it seems to me, of those other situations where we've legalized killing. And, of course, many of us are opposed to capital punishment. We see a gun crisis, which comes in great part out of a proclaimed right of self-defense. And of course, an awful lot of wars, perhaps most wars, may begin justly, but they end in unjust, terrible ways usually. I hate to see a whole new category of killing added here, and particularly a killing superintended by doctors whose role, it seems to me, should be to save life. I suppose, most people think, well, this is my private decision. I should be allowed to make this choice. I guess I see this as one of those private decisions that has enormous social implications. Somebody else's decision to have a doctor kill him or help him take his own life is going to affect my life and the life of everyone else, not just that individual.
How do you see your ideas about a greater acceptance and public understanding of death, how do you see that fitting into healthcare reform?
Well, part of the problem with healthcare reform in this country is precisely that people look to medicine to do, I believe, too much. I mean, we spend more on healthcare than any nation in the world, more in sheer numbers of the amount of money and more per capita. Part of this is that we have a wasteful, crazy, inefficient healthcare system, but part is because we really do look to medicine to do exceptional things with our lives. I think that even if we can have a more efficiently managed system, people will not be able to afford a kind of health care that wants infinite life, that expects to be medicine to rid them of all of their psychological and physical problems. The very high expectations are part of our problem. One of the reasons Europeans both have equitable health care systems. Everybody gets access, but they spend a lot more money. And in great part, it's because people understand that you have to die. People understand that perhaps it's not in our common interest to spend $1 million to save an individual life when there are many other things we can do with that same amount of money to improve life in some other areas. I'm struck in general by the way the other countries manage to have a decent healthcare system, but always behind that is a much greater willingness to accept death and to understand that mortality is part of the human condition. And you just don't keep spending more and more money to fight that.
Dana Callahan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Medical ethicist Daniel Callahan's new book is called The Troubled Dream of Life. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. A face you love to look at. Jerry Adler's face launched his acting career when he came to acting at the age of 62 after years of behind-the-scenes work on Broadway. Coming up, Jerry Adler tells us about his latest role in the new Woody Allen movie, Manhattan Murder Mystery. And commentator Annie Lamott tells us about waiting for the phone to ring. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. officials have announced that 400 additional troops from an elite army unit will be in Somalia within the next few days. The Pentagon says the Army Rangers will help improve security in the capital of Somalia. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
The 75th Ranger Regiment is a shock assault unit like that used in the initial nighttime raid on Panama. The Rangers will join the 1,200-member Quick Reaction Force already in Somalia. The decision to send additional troops came after the deaths of four American soldiers earlier this month, which the United Nations blamed on Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid. While the Rangers are capable of trying to capture Aidid, Pentagon spokeswoman Kathleen Dulaski would not say that was the goal.
To the extent that the Quick Reaction Force is trying to help improve the security situation in Mogadishu, that's what this group is being sent to help. It was seen as an immediate need because of the increasing level of violence to help stabilize the situation on the ground in Mogadishu.
Dulaski said the troops are not being deployed to capture one man, and the mission should not be personalized. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Mission controllers for the Mars Observer satellite had another setback today. They were hoping that the spacecraft would send a signal to Earth indicating it had entered orbit around Mars, but that signal never came. NPR's Joe Palca has more on the story.
There have been no signals at all from the Mars Observer spacecraft since Saturday, but on Friday, controllers had sent the spacecraft all the instructions it needed to fire its engines and enter Mars orbit. One of those commands was to radio Earth after the engines had fired. That signal should have arrived at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena around 2:45 this afternoon Pacific time, but it didn't. Without any transmissions from the spacecraft, mission controllers don't know whether it entered Mars orbit or if it is sailing past the planet. Unless mission controllers hear from the probe, for all practical purposes, this spacecraft will be lost and the $980 million mission a failure. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
Officials of the Clinton administration have announced a federal wetlands policy that leaves most current regulations in place, but closes loopholes that have allowed development of property such as shopping centers and apartments. White House officials see this policy as a compromise between landowners and environmentalists. The measure exempts from federal protection 53 million acres of wetlands that were drained and converted to farm use before 1985. The plan endorses a short-term goal of no net loss of wetlands and a long-term effort to increase wetland acreage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 3 points to close at 3,638, a new high. This is NPR News. U.S. officials say that two U.S. airplanes have airdropped some 13,000 packaged meals over the besieged Bosnian city of Mostar. Defense Department officials say that two C-130 cargo planes were involved in the airdrops of food that were in large boxes that opened up in midair to allow the packages to fall free. There had been reports that allies would drop food for the first time to the Muslim sector of Mostar, where 55,000 people have been under siege by Croatian factions. U.S. officials did not report the airdrop until after the planes were out of the area, said one, planes can get shot at if you announce it in advance. A federal appeals court has heard the Clinton administration request that it reverse a ruling requiring it to file an environmental impact statement on the North American Free Trade Agreement. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The administration is appealing a decision handed down by federal judge Charles Ritchie, saying that it is in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act. Solicitor General Drew Days argued before the three-judge panel that no environmental assessment is needed because that law does not apply to the president. But a lawyer for a public citizen, one of three groups challenging NAFTA, argued that an environmental study is required of all federal agencies. The panel's decision turns on the issue of whether NAFTA is the product of the president's work or that of an agency, in this case, the U.S. Trade Representative. A decision is expected by mid-September, and both sides will likely go to the Supreme Court if it loses this round of appeal. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
According to the International Monetary Fund, U.S. imports and exports came to $1 trillion last year for the first time. Exports and imports were larger than for any other nation. The IMF says the U.S. deficit last year was more than $105 billion. While Japan had less trade, it had a surplus of more than $107 billion. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. For most people, hitting age 60 means it's time to start winding down the career and planning for retirement. That was what Jerry Adler had in mind a few years ago when he was working as the stage manager for the soap opera Santa Barbara. But Adler was spotted on the set by a casting agent who offered him a role in the movie The Public Eye, which starred Joe Pesci. Adler's plans for retirement have been further delayed with Woody Allen's new movie, Manhattan Murder Mystery. Adler plays Paul House, the neighbor of Larry and Carol Lipton, portrayed by Allen and Diane Keaton. House is suspected of murdering his wife, and the Liptons, especially Carol, are determined to solve the crime. Before movies and television, Jerry Adler had a long career on Broadway. He worked as a producer, director, or stage manager for 53 shows, including My Fair Lady and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. 10 years ago, he moved to California to work in television production. After his role in The Public Eye, Adler decided he liked acting, and he took on his daughter as an agent.
And she called me and said, how would you like to go to New York and audition for Woody Allen? Well, he had been a big hero of mine. So I flew into New York, and I saw Juliet in the morning. She gave me 5 scenes that I should look at. And then I went over to see him, and I walked into his, I think it was his screening room, because it was this huge, dark room with one lamp on. And there he was in kind of semi-darkness. And Julian and I read all 5 of those scenes to him, and he was kind of over there in the dark, huddled behind a pillow. So all I could see was his eyes. And I read one scene after the other, and at the end of it, he hopped up and said, James, very good, very good. Where are you going to be this weekend? And I said, I'll be anywhere you want me to be. And I went home, didn't hear anything for about 3 weeks. And then I got the call from my daughter again when I was working on Santa Barbara. She says, you know what? You got the part.
I assume with your theater career, your TV career, working as a stage manager, director, producer, you've seen a lot of auditions in your days.
Oh, yeah.
Any particular do's and don'ts?
Well, the idea, of course, is to be as much of your own, you know, personality as you can be. The hard thing is to be as natural as you can, because most actors are nervous. I have a unique kind of thing. It's not my bread and butter, and it was a new career. It was a lark. So I could be me. It's very hard to do that from what I've seen. You know, most actors, when they come in, are very nervous, and it means a great deal. It could be the next meal. You know, it's not that for me.
But you wanted the part.
Wanted it badly. Never dreamt that I would have it. I was going to this as an experience, really, as a unique kind of to meet him and to go, it never entered my mind that I was going to get this part.
When you saw yourself on the screen, what did you think about how you'd done?
That is the weirdest experience of all, of course, seeing yourself on the screen, because you don't really see yourself. You know, when you're seeing yourself on this giant screen, it's very disconcerting. I had worried about what kind of, you know, performance I was giving, because we never got to see any of the dailies or the rushes or anything like that. So I had no idea whether or not I was doing a good job. I kept checking with Diane, saying, how am I doing? How am I doing? She kept saying, you're still here, aren't you? You're still here.
Well, that was enough to keep
you
going?
I guess that means you're okay. If you're not still there, you're gone.
Why do you think it was important for Woody Allen not to let you see the Rushes, you or any of the actors. Why is that important to him?
It was important. It was so important that we never had a script. We would get scenes that we were going to do in the next couple of days in advance, but we never got to see a whole script. I don't think he wanted anybody to play the end of the movie at the beginning. So he would only give us the information we needed for that day. He didn't want us to see... Both of the films that I've worked on, neither of them would allow the actors to see the Rushes, and I think that's because they don't want the actor to direct themselves. Hmm. And they want to keep you as natural and open as possible. Once you see the scene on the screen, you begin to form ideas, and I don't think they want that.
Do you think it was he was afraid of leaks?
Yes, I think he was afraid of leaks. I don't think he wanted... I also don't think he... Since he is that shy, I think other people's opinions on his work is not anything that he's open to. I think he's really very private about his work. And so to give us, you know, script would encourage us to discuss the piece as a whole. And I don't think he had time for that or wanted to do that. I wasn't even sure whether I was innocent or guilty through the whole movie.
That's interesting.
Until there was certain scenes that brought it out, in which would convince me one way or the other. But for the most part, I was left to play an innocent person, which I thought I am. So, and I think I would have been colored in other directions if I had read the whole script.
You've spent so many years in the theater, mostly on Broadway, and working also in television as well. Have you had secret fantasies of being an actor before?
Never entered my mind.
Really?
Never. And I acted in two plays in college, and that was the last time. I also did one little scene in Search for Tomorrow once with Estelle Getty, where I played Estelle Getty's husband. It was like a two-minute bit that I did. I was asleep at a card game. And those were the only acting things I ever did, and I was always interested really in directing. So I never really, you know, got into the acting thing.
Because the directing was so much more interesting for you? I guess what interests me is that here you are in your 60s, starting a new chapter in your life, getting some very interesting roles, and obviously we can tell from your voice that you're so interested in this new part of your career. And I wonder, someone who's so familiar with theater, how you couldn't know that you wouldn't be interested.
Well, I think I can now play the roles that I've grown into. I don't think I was... I would not have cast me any earlier than I am in my 60s. I don't think I could have played younger parts, character parts, I suppose, but there are the only roles that I'm really good for, I think, are character parts. So I've kind of grown into what I can play now. I suppose that's the way it's working.
I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Jerry Adler, and he plays in the new Woody Allen movie called Manhattan Murder Mystery. He plays the neighbor of the characters that Woody Allen and Diane Keaton play, and he's suspected of murdering his wife. His character's name is Paul House. And for many years, my guest, Jerry Adler, was a Broadway producer, director, and stage manager. He's also worked in television as well. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Jerry Adler. What did you like about stage managing?
Well, it was a way to work with great directors and to learn the craft. I'm a very organized person, so it was interesting to me to get new shows on.
Is that the job of a stage manager, then, to be the organization person?
He is really the the production head of any production, so that he really gets, he gets the show cast, he gets the show designed, he gets the show put on. He is there at rehearsals. After the director leaves, after the opening night, he becomes the erstwhile director. And he keeps the show up. He helps with the recasting if you're lucky enough to have a long run. I did Fair Lady for over 6 years, so I did a lot of recasting. I must have had about 400 people in that show. And it's a way of directing before you become a director. It's a kind of a training ground for directors.
What would you say was the high point of your Broadway career?
I think working with Morse Hart on Fair Lady. And I did Coco with Katharine Hepburn. I worked with Angela Lansbury in Dear World. Those were wonderful shows. I did a play called The Homecoming by Harold Pinter, which I thought was the best play that I did. But there's been so many shows that it's hard to remember which ones I've done.
What would you say was the low point?
Low point was the last two musicals I directed on Broadway.
Which were?
Which was The Little Prince with Michael York, which unfortunately never even opened. We ran out of money in previews. And the very last show I did was Play Me a Country Song at the Virginia, which was a kind of odd piece, which only ran about a week.
Now, how did you get involved in those particular plays?
I was the production stage manager, actually, on both of them, and they fired the directors. And I, unfortunately, was dragged in and shanghaied into directing them. So I wound up with all the blame and none of the credit.
So these were reluctant jobs you had,
yeah.
even before they failed?
And they really, if you have two flops in a row on Broadway, you're kind of on the bad list. So I was having a hard time getting jobs.
What is it like, though, as a director, to direct something that you know is bad and is going to fail?
Well, you know, there's wishful thinking. Everybody begins to think, hey, this is better than it was yesterday. This is getting better. This is going to be okay. Everybody starts to say, hey, everybody's beginning to think that maybe it's going to work. And then you do opening night, and boom, it doesn't work.
And where are you opening night?
Ugh. In the back, in the street, everywhere, dying somewhere.
So did you then, after Play Me a Country Song and the critics went after it, did you really figure this was the end of my Broadway career?
Well, it was a question of either going back into stage managing or getting back into television, directing there. So I decided to try directing in television for a while. Took a job on Search for Tomorrow and did that for about a year. And then I did a sitcom with Tony Randall called Love, Sydney. And I did that for about 6 months. And then they canceled Search for Tomorrow. And I said, well, let me give it the West Coast a try because my children were out there. So I moved out there for a while and got into Santa Barbara. And I kind of figured that's where I would kind of end it all.
And that's Santa Barbara, the soap opera.
Yeah.
Right.
And then the day I left that to do the Woody Allen movie is the day that they canceled Santa Barbara. So they kind of said to me, you know what, you're out of the production business.
So was TV work a good antidote to Broadway?
It's much more simplistic. Of course, the money is better, but it's not the same kind of work. It's not as fulfilling or as enjoyable or as intellectual.
There's something I have to check out with you, and I read that you thought the musical Cats by Andrew Lloyd Webber was really a Jewish musical, spelled K-A-T-Z. Did you really?
Well, I had met Jerry Schoenfeld one night at an opening of, I can't remember what it was, but we walked down the aisle together. He said, what are you doing? I said, I think I'm going to move out to the West Coast. He said, why don't you do a show? I'm doing a new musical from England called Cats. And he said, why don't you give me a call at the office? And I went home that night and I said, well, do a Jewish musical called Cats. What could that be about? So I never called him.
You never checked the spelling on it?
No. Never entered my mind. It was a T.S. Eliot thing. So I remember when I was living out on the West Coast when I was doing a play that was on tour. And I got a wire from Herman Levin, who was going to produce My Fair Lady. And he said, would you come to New York and be the stage manager of a musical version of Pygmalion? And I remember saying, a musical version of Pygmalion? That sounds terrible. Thank God I did that job.
Of course, we know what that was.
Yes. That was Fair Lady.
As someone who has directed then stage plays, working in movies now, do you have to sort of undo some of the things that you were working with some of your actors on?
Well, I never acted yeah. on the stage, so I'm not really sure. I've only acted in these few things that I've done. I try to keep it as natural as I can. As I say, I look at each scene as I would direct it and try to, I'm just beginning to learn a kind of technique, but I may have to go to class at my age. My God.
Who would you go study with?
I don't know. Who would take me on?
Well, is this what you thought retirement would be like?
Well, I thought I'd kind of retire and travel and have a lot of fun. I just became a grandfather, and it's all kind of fun. And I would—that's what I would, you know, be doing. I've been working in this business for 43 years, and I put my time in. I figured I'd be able to relax a little bit, and here I go with this whole new thing. But acting in film is very seductive.
How so?
Well, they spoil you rotten. I mean, all the things I used to do for actors now everybody's doing. You know, for me, it's really a treat. I mean, they picked me up in a limo to bring me over here to meet you. I could have taken a cab, but God forbid.
What are some of the other perks you get as an actor?
Well, you get a trailer. You live in a Winnebago on the set. You have your own dressing room. You have people who dress you, people who comb your hair. It's unbelievable. Things you should be able to do for yourself.
Jerry Adler, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Producer, director, stage manager, turned actor Jerry Adler is in the new Woody Allen movie, Manhattan Murder Mystery. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the stories they'll be covering on All Things Considered today. Robert, what's up?
Well, we'll be hearing today about more U.S. troops being sent to Somalia. We'll hear an eyewitness account of the Bosnian city of Mostar, where a convoy arrived today. Reporter Kurt Schork of Reuters says the scene discovered there was the worst devastation that he has seen in the past year of covering the fighting in Bosnia. Also, news of newly discovered letters of Thomas Jefferson about agriculture, what's going on between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, and a story about a community school board near San Diego with a new program for teaching, perhaps, creationism.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. From time to time, writer Annie Lamott joins us with an entry from her diary about life with her almost 4-year-old, Sam. Here's the latest.
I got clean and sober 7 years ago today, but for the last few weeks and until this afternoon, there's been rampant addiction again in the house that I share with my young son, Sam. We've been sort of broke for a while. I'm a single mother, which means I'm the only hunter around here, and the moose steaks in the freezer are running out. But I had a new book published recently, and Hope Springs Eternal, and somewhere along the line the phone became like a giant syringe or a plate of cocaine. It caused huge highs, lows, cravings, withdrawals. Every time it rang, my heart leapt with anticipation of it being someone who wanted to give me vulgar amounts of money or at least a spot on a TV talk show. And coincidentally, once I started sitting by the phone, looking like I was doing Lamaze, Sam started spending more and more time out in his playhouse. He has this big second-hand plastic playhouse out front where he sometimes just sits by himself, thinking. On good days, when I'm feeling spiritually fit, I see the playhouse as a sort of training zendo, because he can sit there doing nothing, just concentrating, with a small smile. But on bad days, I see it as where we will be living if Maury Povich doesn't call soon. There's a tea set out there for shots of apple juice and a plastic phone on the wall, which Sam mostly uses to summon me when he spots a snail. He hates snails, despises snails, and I come running, unless, of course, I'm on my own phone getting a hit. So it's mostly been lonely around here, what with me strung out on the phone and Sam out in his playhouse so much. But I think I may have finally found my way back home. It was a slow day around here today. Maury Povich still hadn't called, and I was working at my desk, craving the right phone call, when it finally, finally rang. "Yes, Lord," I cried, but it was just a friend. I sighed, all but drumming my fingers as I listened, thinking bitterly, Oprah's probably trying to get a hold of me, and here you are tying up the line. So I rejoiced when Sam began to call, snails, snails, from his playhouse. I said to my friend, I'm sorry, Sam needs me. I'll have to call you later. Then I went outside and picked up the tiny snail that Sam had spotted in one corner. It was actually lovely, but so delicate that my fingers went through the shell and broke it. It made me feel sad and a little creepy, but I tossed it into the garden. And I really did mean to sit down with Sam and let him pour us both a cup of tea, but right then the phone rang again and I rushed outside. This time it was someone important, an editor of a big newspaper, and I was instantly bathed in the narcotic of validation. It was exactly like when your new lover finally calls. This editor was sort of fawning on me, and my first thought was, I love that in a guy. And I settled in for a nice long talk when suddenly Sam started calling to me again. He'd spotted another snail. I rolled my eyes and kept talking. Then I noticed that I was wiping my hand off on my pants, the hand with which I'd broken the tiny snail shell, wiping and wiping away like Lady Macbeth in blue jeans. I stopped in my tracks. Slides started playing on the screen in my head of all those years I was drinking and how much wiping goes along with the territory, how much spilling and waste is involved, how many things need to be wiped up or wiped away or rubbed in. Sam called me again. God, I said out loud. Now I was seeing slides of tense, lonely children watching their parents wipe away at themselves. The important man said, excuse me? And I said, my son needs me. I'll have to call you back. And I hung up the phone and stormed out to the playhouse as if I was holding an Uzi with which to blow away all those loathsome snails with which to protect my child.
Annie Lamott is the author of Operating Instructions, a journal of my son's first year. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Nancy Greenlees. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. We talk with writer Susan Sontag about directing the Samuel Beckett play In a City Under Siege. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.